wait to see you too. Okay, bye. My wife is 2 minutes away.
You said she was at work.
A bitch like her, she probably got fired. You gotta get out of here.
What? Wait, are you serious? The fire?
Angie, you gotta go now.
It's snowing.
I had fun. I'll call you.
But why do I have to leave? This is the perfect chance to come clean about us.
Angie, not now. Just go. My wife will be here any second.
She's dead.
Calm down. Murder's not the answer.
No. I mean her.
In New York City, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous. These are their stories.
Hey guys, welcome to Munch My Benson. My name is Adam. I'm all alone again. The wife and kid have abandoned me once more. They are taking advantage of the probably the last time that Max will get to fly free as an under 2-year-old. So, you know, more power to them. They're going to go celebrate great grandma's 99th birthday. So they're having tons of fun. And I'm stuck here all alone.
Did they drop you off at the Great Slave Lake?
Basically. I'm fashioning a muskox scrotum into a useful tool.
Cool.
But I'm joined along by Josh. How are things up in the still frozen north, maybe? I don't know.
No. It was actually like, it's been pleasant for the last 2 or 3 days. We even had the window open today.
Oh, nice.
You know, let some of that fresh air in.
Yeah, so. That's very nice. I would open the window here more, except my windows.
You live in New York City.
Face out onto fucking First Avenue, and
yeah,
it's either a car alarm or a like truck with its engine brake on, or like a
parade of protesters.
Or like drunk chicks brunching too hard. You know, it's like if it ain't one thing, it's the other. Man, there's been so much going on. I don't even know where to start. But let's see. I did go to my first baseball game of the season today. Nice. That was fun. I went to see the Mets play at Citi Field this afternoon. I got a very cheap seat. Saw them play the Braves. Well, yeah, Atlanta. I don't like saying the Braves. Fuck Atlanta.
Yeah.
I saw them play Atlanta. And it was a tight pitcher's duel until some poor management decisions by the Mets ended that in a hurry. But that was fun. I had a blast. It's nice how easy it is to do stuff like that here, because I can just like hop on the train and all of a sudden, you know, 45 minutes later, I emerge out of the station and I'm there.
How far is the walk to the nearest station from your place?
My house, 5 minutes.
Okay.
So it's 5 minutes to the train. It's a couple transfers to get to Citi, but it's not bad ones. And then it drops you off right there, man.
We were like 10 minutes from the red line in LA.
Nice. But. Yeah, nice.
I've been watching We Own This City as well. So,
nice.
Which is not fun.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's David Simon. Mm. So it's important.
Yeah. Polemic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously it's just based on the Gun Trace Task Force in Baltimore, you know, being basically organized crime.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fun times.
I mean, it's a good way to avoid capture, to be the police, you know. But Josh, I think we should like kind of keep the banter short, because I think we have a lot.
One quick thing.
Oh, yeah, please. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got a few new patrons to welcome aboard. So thanks to Zach B, Jessica W, and Barry W. Your support is much appreciated.
Absolutely. We really, really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
But guys, we have a lot of episode to get to this week. So I think without further ado, we should jump into it. This week, we are watching season 11, episode 18. It's called Bedtime. And before we jump into bed with this episode, Josh, are you drinking anything?
I sure am. You remember this fucking Zarkan?
Yeah.
File me under Funky Wild Ale, which is a mixed culture farmhouse ale. It is delightful. It is from Indeed Brewing. This is what I think the third podcast that I've recorded that I was drinking that on.
Nice.
One of ours. And then, our Fuck My Work Life spot that, we recorded on Friday, I would guess it will have dropped, what, 3 weeks before this episode does?
Most likely.
But if this is out there, there should be a Fuck My Work Life episode that you can listen to with Adam and I, where I feel like we were a runaway train.
I feel like the episode that will drop will be a lot different than the episode that I participated in. Also, I feel like Kay has a lot of work to do.
Kay's got her work cut out for her. She is really fucked. Adam and I talked for so long. We basically like took over the mic.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. But yeah, we're going to take over the mic here where actually people expect us to. But let's do it, man. Oh, I never said what I was drinking. Yeah, I'm drinking a Cigar City Brewing High Lie, which is IPA. It's good beer. I got it for a decent price. So
Cigar City's out of Tampa, right?
Yeah, Cigar City's from.
Anyway, this episode. That's all for the Patreon listeners.
Yeah, a lot of baseball chat for you guys.
Sorry,
it could have been much worse. We are watching season 11, episode 18, Bedtime. Larry thought he was smart. He thought he could heat things up with side piece Angie on a cold winter's night while his awful wife was at work.
Nope.
But he was wrong. She is but 2 minutes away, so loser Larry does the gentlemanly thing and forces his half-dressed girlfriend to exit out the fire escape rather than confront the mess his life has become. On her way down, Angie spots Larry's downstairs neighbor, Jane Whitmore, dead, face down on her bed, naked with her hands bound behind her back, her throat slit, and an X carved into her cheek. Later, Benson, Stabler, and Warner are investigating the scene. While Jane apparently has been raped, the lack of blood means the mutilation had most likely occurred post-mortem as a signature. Jane was a freelance investigative journalist, so it's possible she was killed trying to silence her next story. Jane's editor tells B&E how Jane would go deep undercover for her work exposing all manner of underworld creeps like sex and drug traffickers. Her latest story was about a hedge fund investor who'd already been convicted of running a fraudulent scheme and was now out of prison and possibly running a new fraudulent scheme. Next stop is fraudster Morris Ostabau's new endeavor, a pet mortuary. The problem is that this new venture seems to be an earnest, above-board operation. Ostabau tells the team that Whitmore had thrown herself at him only to lose interest when she realized he was running a perfectly legit business. She did, however, want information about Harmony Home, the halfway house he'd been assigned to during his initial parole. Seems like she smelled a story there. The house is a rough den of drugs and prostitution, but the house manager claims he's doing the best he can. Jane was pretending to be a recovering junkie and stayed for about 10 days, which to Stabler and Benson can only mean that she was onto a story. Jane's lone friend at the house, Francine, points them towards a handsy welfare caseworker who handled nearly every woman's file at the house. Ned Bogdan, the caseworker, is a neatly dressed older man who lives alone with his mom, forces welfare recipients to perform sexual favors in exchange for their rightful benefits, and had made a career out of schmoozing his superiors. It's gonna take a lot of work to nail this creep, right? Well, Benson knows how to catch a fly with honey, so she goes undercover as a recently homeless and fully at her wit's end woman with impeccable hair and makeup. Her sob story and exposed tank top strap have the desired effect. Within 1 minute, Bogdan is closing the blinds. Within three, he's feeling up her breasts, and within four, he's under arrest. While Benson and Elliot interview Bogdan, Cragen realizes the MO in this case matches a serial killer active in the 70s called the Bedtime Butcher. There were five previous victims, all tied up and mutilated. The investigative detective in those cases died young from a heart attack, so SVU is now trying to close six open murders. It doesn't take much for them to tie Bogdan to all but one of the previous vics. He had problems with four of the five women and also left dandruff all over them. Bogdan's going down.
All over them.
Bogdan's going down, but one murder from 1976, that of Emily Cutler, doesn't match. Ned was in Cheyenne, Wyoming at the time, and in addition to there being no dandruff on the corpse, there were long blonde hairs from a woman at the scene when the victim was a redhead. 5 cases closed, 1 to go. Emily had been married to Cal Cutler, the mattress maestro. He was a local celebrity back in those days due to his extremely suggestive TV ads where he'd be surrounded by a bevy of half-dressed buxom blondes. The old case files imply that Cal was doing a lot more than acting with said blondes. In fact, there were more than a dozen disturbance calls to the police from Emily the year she was murdered, all involving Cal's cuties. Cal died in a drunk driving accident within a year of Emily's death, but thankfully the beat cop who responded to most of the disturbance calls is still living around the corner from me in Yorkville on the Upper East Side. When Benson and Stabler knock on her door, it's abundantly clear that Susan Delzio would have been Cad Cal's exact type back in the day. She keeps the detectives in the building lobbies and she's having a unit remodeled, but otherwise she provides the team with a bunch of reasonably useful background on the case. She sends them to Cal's talent agent, Maud, who in turn points them towards the nuttiest of Cal's former conquests, Jenny Coswald, Claire Lockton, and Rita Wills. Jenny and Claire are both pretty square now, but Rita is perpetually wine drunk and still dwells on her glory days. Also, Rita's blood was found all over Emily's mattress. When the detectives confront her, Rita loses her shit and nearly stabs Stabler with a broken martini glass. At the precinct, the perma-sauced Rita explains the blood. Cal had convinced Rita to have sex on Emily's bed with the intention of being caught, which would cause Emily to break things off with Cal, which would nullify their prenup. Well, Rita's time of the month showed up early, which disgusted Cal and stopped the party before Emily got home. Instead of throwing them away, Rita claims to have saved the sheets after 35 years. She then allows Olivia and Elliot to go check out her apartment and find out. Her apartment is a total freak show. Every inch is covered with Cal Cutler memorabilia. Amongst the life-size cutouts and old ads, they find Rita's old diaries. In one, she says she killed for Cal, and then seems to say she killed Cal as well. In interrogation, Rita tells them the truth. She didn't kill Emily. She's been a wreck ever since she followed through with Cal's demand that she get an abortion. So her revenge was getting Cal completely wasted and letting him drive home drunk the night of his death. Warner does her thing and exhumes Cal's bone. While the body matches the initial coroner's findings, there's one slight problem. Cal Cutler was about 8 inches taller than the body that's been buried in his grave for 35 years. This leaves only one buxom blonde from the 70s with the means, opportunity, and possibly the motive to murder Emily Cutler, retired patrol officer Delzio. She was a rookie cop with stars in her eyes when she met Cal, but she was also a smart and ruthless one, so she'd hatched a plan to get rid of the competition for her man. She killed Emily using the bedtime butcher's exact MO, then she convinced Cal to fake his own death using the transient as a less than willing patsy. She pushes back against this, but Elliot opens the door and lets Susan's really badly burned soulmate Cal into the interview room. He doused himself in gasoline whilst faking his own death and has been hiding in Susan's apartment ever since. After 35 years, the mystery of the mattress maestro and the bedtime butcher are laid to rest, and we are left with a, was Cal hiding in Susan's apartment or in the special effects makeup department of the 1991 disaster of a film, Nothing But Trouble All These Years, Dick Wolf?
Yeah, yeah, it feels very much like that.
It's the makeup is distracting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I loved it.
Yeah, I mean,
I loved how distracting the makeup was, but
yeah, man, just the sheer number of plot twists and celebrities involved is
I mean, just plot alone, there's like, I don't know, it feels like you could have made 6 different episodes of television from what they just throw away casually in this.
Easily. Just
yeah, like, think about how early the reporter shit's done.
The reporter shit is done in like a heartbeat, and then all of a sudden the Atherton thing, and you're like, oh my god, William Atherton is like, which, I mean, we haven't talked about who the stars are, guests are. William Atherton is outstanding in this.
Yeah, but they use him, I don't know, by minute 20?
If that.
By minute 20, he's not in it
anymore? Yeah, it's like 5 minutes and he's gone. Yeah. And then it's like, oh my God.
It's wild.
It's like every other recognizable woman of this type from the 70s. It's amazing. I want you to guess who I would have known the best as a child.
I mean, it would be hilarious if it was Susan Anton.
Ding, 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 ding.
Did you grow up watching
Cannonball Run 2, Josh. Cannonball okay. Run 2. She was the one of the Lamborghini girls.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that was the one with the Muppets in it. And I watched that one a lot.
Yeah, she's got a really weird career.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyways, I guess that's a good segue.
Okay, so guest stars. Wow.
Yeah.
Do we have them? Do I have notes on them?
There's so many.
It's very wild. We've got to start with Jacqueline Smith.
Yeah.
Who's playing Susan Delzio.
Sure.
My wife is named after her.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I can't wait until she hears that because she is not listening right now. but yeah, that's my understanding at least.
Nice.
It's definitely why her name is spelled the way it is. Anyway, she was born in Houston to a dentist. She graduated from Mirabel Lamar High School in Houston and went to Trinity University in San Antonio for a year before leaving to study at Balanchine School of American Ballet in New York. She did commercials in the late 60s and early 70s, namely as the Breck girl for Breck Shampoo and later as a spokesmodel for Wella Balsam Shampoo. You know, she's got shampoo hair.
Yeah, she does. Sense.
Her big break was when she landed in Charlie's Angels with Kate Jackson and Farrah Fawcett. She was the only one of the main cast to last from beginning to end of the series. She earned a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress in a Miniseries or TV Film for her starring role in 1981's Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy. She did a slew of TV movies and miniseries through the 80s and 90s, including playing Marie in a 1988 Bourne Identity miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain as Jason Bourne. She is also in The Night They Saved Christmas, Danielle Steele's Kaleidoscope, Danielle Steele's Family Album. And she also got to star in her 4-installment series, which was part of the weekly ABC mystery movie block, Christine Cromwell, which was created by Dick Wolf and developed by Wolf's old friend Michael Dugan. Her only real starring roles in a theatrical release were in Deja Vu, the 1985 reincarnation love story, courtesy of Canon Films, and Night Kill, a 1980 thriller with a top-billed Robert Mitchum, who was barely in the movie. In the 1980s, she also pioneered the role of celebrities developing their own fashion lines, with her line, which was carried in Kmarts across the country. She had recurring roles in The District, Becker, Hope and Faith, and CSI, and she reprised her role from Charlie's Angels in each of the two newer film series, so the Elizabeth Banks one and then Full Throttle, but she wasn't in the first Charlie's Angel movie. She was married to actor Roger Davis, actor Dennis Cole, filmmaker Tony Richmond, with whom she had two children, and she is presently married to cardiothoracic surgeon Brad Allen. She was treated for breast cancer in 2003. She was also the inspiration for the Air song Kelly Watch the Stars, the titular female being Kelly Garrett, her Charlie's Angels character. Next up, Anne Margaret, who's playing Rita Wills.
Yeah.
This is like a next level nuts performance in the best way possible, and it won her an Emmy. So
she won an Emmy for this.
She won an Emmy for this.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Hold, Josh, I need to pause you real quick. Hold on. I'm sorry. Sure. Phone call.
This is Jim Rockford. At the tone, leave your name and message. I'll get back to you.
Teddy's Treehouse. You've won our free landscaping services for one full year. We'll mow your lawn, top your trees, mulch, seed, fertilize, and feed. Isn't that wonderful?
That glimpse into Adam's personal life.
I tried to keep it
Patreon
short.
Patreon listeners.
Yeah, I tried to keep it short. Megan says hi, Josh.
Okay.
And she says hi, listeners.
And to all you munchies.
Yeah. Anne Margaret.
Rita Wells.
Yeah.
On an Emmy.
She really goes for it. And
yeah, she, wow. She is wasting no time and doing everything possible in this episode. And it's great. Mm-hmm. I love it. She's born in Stockholm, Sweden. Moved to central Sweden, and then at 5, her family moved to the U.S., eventually settling in Willamette, Illinois, which is about 14 miles north of downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. She took dance classes in Chicago, eventually making it on air in various Chicago shot variety / dance shows. She enrolled at Northwestern, but while there was performing in a nightclub act, the Subtle Tones, who headed out west for a brief tour, eventually earning her an audition with George Burns in Las Vegas, leading to a contract with RCA Victor. Victor and the release of her first album in 1961, which earned her the moniker of the female Elvis because of her husky contralto voice.
Yeah.
She was nominated the next year for the Grammy for Best New Artist in 1961. She also screen tested at 20th Century Fox and was signed to a 7-year contract, doing Pocketful of Miracles and State Fair before her star turn as Kim in Bye Bye Birdie.
Yeah.
She co-starred in Viva Las Vegas with Elvis Presley the next year, recording 3 duets with him, only one of which made the final cut and none of which were commercially released until after Presley's death, quote, air quote death. We all know he didn't die.
Yeah.
And this was all born from Colonel Tom Parker's fears that Anne Margaret's presence threatened to overshadow Elvis. She was also romantically linked to Elvis at this time, but within a year she'd met her eventual husband, actor Roger Smith, who would also eventually become her manager. She has been Oscar nominated for Carnal Knowledge and Tommy. She was Golden Globe nominated for Pocketful of Miracles, Bye Bye Birdie, Carnal Knowledge, Tommy, Joseph Andrews, Who Will Love My Children, A Streetcar Named Desire, that 1984 TV movie that I have no memory of, The Two Mrs. Grenvilles, Life of the Party, and Alex Haley's Queen, winning the Globe on 5 of those nominations.
Wow.
She was Emmy nominated for Who Will Love My Children, Streetcar, The Two Mrs. Grenvilles, Alex Haley's Queen, Life of the Party, and this episode of SVU, for which she won Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series.
Yeah.
You've also seen her in Once a Thief, The Cincinnati Kid, RPM, The Train Robbers, Magic, The Villain, I Ought to Be in Pictures, 52 Pickup, Newsies, Grumpy Old Men, Grumpier Old Men, Any Given Sunday, The Breakup, The Santa Claus 3, The Escape Clause, Old Dogs, and Going in Style. On TV, you've seen her in the Scarlet miniseries, 3 episodes of Third Watch, 2 Ray Donovans, 2 Kominsky Methods, and 2 episodes of the Maloney vehicle, Happy. Next up, Morgan Fairchild, who's playing Claire Lockton.
Yeah.
She grew up in the DFW area where her mother was a high school English teacher at Richardson High School. Her first acting job was at 17 as a double for Faye Dunaway in Bonnie and Clyde, mostly used in the driving scenes because Faye Dunaway could not drive a stick shift. There was a marriage in there too. She got married at like 17 and that ended by 23. So right after the divorce, she moved to New York City because she wasn't getting any acting work in Dallas. She got her first credited on-screen role in the daytime soap Search for Tomorrow, which is also one of the early breaks for Kevin Bacon, Jill Clayburgh, and Munch alums Jane Krakowski and Michael Nouri. She did the whole TV guest spot thing after leaving Search for Tomorrow, popping up in episodes of Kojak, Happy Days, The Bob Newhart Show, Dallas, and Mork and Mindy, before landing her first series regular role on a primetime show in the soapy Flamingo Road, which netted her a Golden Globe nomination but was canceled after 2 seasons. This sent her back into the TV guest spot cycle, along with making her feature debut, starring in The Seduction alongside Andrew Stevens. She was main cast in Paper Dolls, both North and South miniseries, 1 season of Falcon Crest, and then Falcon Crest was canceled, The City, Fashion House, and had recurring roles in Roseanne, Sybil, Friends, where she was Chandler's mom, Roswell, The Bold and the Beautiful, Chuck, and Days of Our Lives. She was nominated for an Emmy for a guest appearance on Murphy Brown and a daytime Emmy for her guest work on Days of Our Lives in 2017. You've seen her on the big screen in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Redheaded Stranger, Naked Gun 33 and a Third, Holy Man, Walk Hard, The Slammin' Salmon, and Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2.
A classic film.
She was married to inventor, musician, executive Jack Calmes, C-A-L-M-E-S, from the ages of 17 to 23. She is an AIDS and environmental activist. Next up, William Atherton, who's playing Ned Bogdan. He was born in Orange, Connecticut. He studied acting at the drama school at Carnegie Tech and graduated from Carnegie Mellon University. He did a bunch of stage work in New York after graduating, working with David Rabe and Arthur Miller, among others. He got his big break in the Sugarland Express before landing in darker dramas like The Day of the Locust and Looking for Mr. Goodbar. He is surely best known for his 4-film odious Shitheel Quadrilogy, Ghostbusters, Real Genius, Die Hard, and Die Hard 2. He was so effective at being a piece of shit.
Yeah.
That following the release of Ghostbusters, he was routinely harassed on the streets and challenged to fights in bars. Specifically, people would yell dickless at him because of the wonderful scene in which they say he's dickless, and then Bill Murray confirms he has no dick. He provided main vocals for the song What'll I Do for Robert Redford's film version of The Great Gatsby. He's been married to writer Bobby Golden since 1980. On The Phil Donahue Show in 1981, he said he was once homosexual, but changed due to the aesthetic realism of Eli Siegel.
Interesting.
Whatever the fuck that means.
All right.
You've seen him in the films No Mercy, Oscar, The Pelican Brief, Biodome, Hoodlum, The Crow, Salvation, The Last Samurai, The Girl Next Door, and Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie. He's had recurring roles or been in multiple episodes of Centennial, The Equalizer, the original series, The Twilight Zone, the 1980s incarnation, Murder, She Wrote. Obviously, I know you were waiting for that, Adam.
He's a couple classic Murder, She Wrote appearances.
Sure, yeah. Sure. They're all classics, though, aren't they, Adam?
Some of them more than others, but yeah.
The Practice, Desperate Housewives, Life, and Defiance.
You might be surprised to find he plays a pedantic shitheel in those, you know.
I'm shocked. He's also been in two episodes of the original series.
So, Josh, I have two possible entrants into our movie club from this, but I'll get to the
Definitely have one.
I have one from Atherton, and I have one from Jacqueline Smith, and I forgot to bring hers.
I have one from Renee Taylor.
Interesting.
As well.
Interesting. Okay. Great.
Okay. Susan Anton.
Yeah.
She's playing Jenny Coswold.
Yeah, she is.
Adam knows her from fucking Cannonball Run 2, where she's one of the Lamborghini girls.
I mean, it's a classic film, Josh. It's got tons of great stars in it, including Muppets.
It's got all the stars. So she was born in Oakland, California. She went to Yucaipa High School and San Bernardino Valley College. She was Miss California and second runner-up for Miss America in 1969. She gained a following because of a series of Muriel cigar commercials that she appeared in. I think Wikipedia page, she appeared on the Merv Griffin Show approximately 30 times, but I don't know. I can't confirm that. And she was seen/heard in the Perfect Sleeper Mattress by Serta ads across like all platforms, so radio, TV, whatever. She had a short-lived variety series in 1978, which she co-hosted with country singer Mel Tillis, who was not really a household name at the time. That lasted for, I believe, 4 episodes. Then the next year, she had her own variety show, Presenting Susan Anton, that aired a few times to little response. She starred in the 1979 Joseph Sargent-directed sci-fi sports drama Golden Girl, all one word, where her adoptive neo-Nazi doctor father injected her with vitamins and hormones to create a super athlete. She's then sent to Moscow with the goal of winning 3 races at the 1980 Summer Olympics. She was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best New Star in a Motion Picture, female, for this role.
Gotta say, that sounds kind of badass to me. Maybe we should put that one on the list, too.
I don't think it's available anywhere. Okay, it's right very on. Strange.
Yeah.
The attempts to create star vehicles for her petered off pretty quickly, and she fell into the professional attractive person loop of appearing as herself or in single episode guest star mode, popping up on award shows and in Murder, She Wrote, Mr. Belvedere, Quantum Leap, Night Court, Blossom, The Larry Sanders Show, and probably most notably as Nicole Eggert's divorced single mom in Baywatch. She was married to Jack Stein, dated Sylvester Stallone in the early 80s while he was married, and dated the much shorter Dudley Moore. Like, she's 5'11". He's really not 5'11". She is now married to actor Jeff Lester. Golden Girl seems insane to me.
It appears to be on YouTube. There appears to be a full version of it.
We can put it on the short list.
I'm not going to start it right now because I don't want to fuck up our audio, but obviously. It does appear to be there.
So we can add it to the short list.
Yeah.
I've added one from our next person to our shortlist also.
Nice.
Renee Taylor, who's playing Maude Monahan.
Yeah.
She was born in the Bronx, graduated from the Academy of Dramatic Arts. She acted with improv groups in the 1950s and worked as a comedian in the early 1960s at Bonsoir, where her opening act was a young Barbara Streisand. Mm. She wrote a few movies with her second husband, Joseph Bologna, with whom she wrote the Broadway hit Lovers and Other Strangers, which they then adapted for the big screen and received an Oscar nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay in 1971. In 1972, they were nominated for a Writers Guild Award for Best Comedy written directly for the screen for Made for Each Other. And the year after that, they won an Emmy for writing Acts of Love and other comedies. You've seen her in The Producers, The Detective, A New Leaf, White Palace, Delirious, The Alfie Remake, Life During Wartime, The Do-Over, and How to Be a Latin Lover. On TV, she's probably most well-known for being on The Nanny, mm-hmm. where I believe she played Fran Drescher's mother.
She did.
But she also had recurring roles on Dream On, Saint Elsewhere, and How I Met Your Mother. Mm. Most importantly, she and her husband wrote and directed Love Is All There Is, that fucking insane City Island shot modern retelling of Romeo and Juliet, starring a super young Angelina Jolie doing an incomprehensible accent, and Munch alum Nathaniel Marston as a star-crossed Romeo and Juliet.
Nice.
So, since now we've got two reasons to watch that, I've added that on the list.
Okay.
I've talked about it before, but I kind of want to inflict that on other people. It is nuts.
Excellent.
But we'll see. We'll see. Shortlist. We don't need to marry ourselves to it. I've only got one more guest star to talk about.
Fantastic.
Because we've talked for so long about these guest stars.
I can't wait to talk about these two movies that I've that have piqued my interest. But go all on, right. Go on.
in addition to fucking Love Is All There Is and Golden Girl.
Yeah.
So Nicole Sudhouse, who's playing Angie.
Oh, okay.
The girl going down the fire escape.
Yeah.
We saw her back in Munch My Benson episode 101. Mm. Did you see that? Did you see Amaro in that towel? Mm. Where we were talking about season 15, episode 22, Reasonable Doubt. There she played Bree, who I believe was Bradley Whitford's assistant. She's also in One Criminal Intent. Very few credits, but she had a jewelry shop, The Golden Carrot in Hoboken, that looks to have closed there and reopened in Charlotte. Mm. You'll have no idea how I found that, but I'm not going to get into it. And she does not go by the name Nicole Sudhouse either.
Weird.
So, like, I really had to do some digging to happen across that information. Anyway, I guess if you're in Charlotte, go to the Golden Carrot and buy jewelry.
Excellent.
Yeah. So you have two movies to potentially add.
Yeah. First is a Jacqueline Smith star vehicle. It's starring her and Robert Mitchum. It's called Night Kill from 1980. Mm-hmm. It's one that I've not seen, but it's
I talked about it for a second, but Mitchum's barely in it, apparently.
Really? Oh, well, it fits into kind of our, like, kind of like grit and bleak kind of genre of films that we've watched. Apparently, it is extremely dark, and by dark, they're talking about the actual
lighting.
So it's kind of a piece with Night of the Juggler. Now, there is a HD, quote-unquote HD version available.
As HD as a fucking YouTube version of... Yeah.
Yeah. As a YouTube print of a film from 1980 can be. But that's one, and it looks just intriguing. Like, I would see that. But the one that really has me going is a Atherton star vehicle that also features a young William H. Macy and a very young Sam Waterston as well.
Okay.
Both playing, I believe, trolls in the film The Boy Who Loved Trolls, which looks fucking nuts, Josh. It also is filmed like in my neighborhood because I was kind of like scanning through it a little bit. And it's all where I take my goddamn dog and kid for like walks. Along the East River. And I mean, look at some of the art for this film and also look at like Sam Waterston as an elf troll and tell me you don't want to see this movie.
No, it's Susan Anton's in it.
Susan Anton's in it too?
Yeah, Atherton's not.
Is it not Atherton? Is it Anton?
No. Yeah, it's Anton.
Oh, fuck. Why did I think it was Atherton?
No idea.
Because I got my notes all fucking confused. As I don't write notes for this shit. I just open tabs.
Yeah.
That's why Josh takes the time and effort to write that shit out. So you don't have me claiming that William Atherton is in a film that he's not.
Man, that movie looks
completely fucking nuts, right?
Have you seen the cover art?
Yes.
That looks horrifying.
I don't know if we're looking at the same cover art, because I'm looking at it.
I'm on the Wikipedia page.
Intense elven William H. Macy and a delightfully elven Sam Waterston. And it looks glorious, Josh.
No, I'm watching. I'm looking at the VHS cover art of a child hugging a Muppet thing.
Uh-huh.
Presumably that's one of the trolls, but it looks.
But there's also I'm like scanning through it right now. It's available for free.
This was also made for a PBS series, Wonderworks.
Yes, but it is for free. And it, I mean, I'm telling you, Josh,
I feel bad about maybe making people watch Love Is All There Is.
I don't know, man.
And I feel like that's got a lot more value.
I think that if you started to look at some of the content.
I think you need to watch this with Max first.
I think that if you started looking at some of the content in this, you would it might change your mind, because it looks completely insane. And this is the kind of film, like She's Too Young, that you're not going to. I mean, except for somehow our weird listeners.
It's 58 minutes.
Yeah, it's very short.
Yeah, our weird listeners have all seen She's Too Young.
Yeah, I know, but normal people have not.
That is our audience. They'd already seen She's Too Young.
So I just want to start by saying that I have a running bitch count for this episode.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, Atherton.
Well, not just him, like many characters.
Yeah, but Atherton definitely uses it. The husband whose wife
Larry uses
whose
it.
Terrible wife is coming home.
Lots of people use it. But yeah, Larry's the first one to drop it. I believe there are 6 instances where the word bitch is said. Which seems like a lot for an SVU.
It seems like a lot for anything, really. But.
Yeah.
So Larry is a great husband.
Delightful cold open. I love it when they do this. When they give us, it's world building is what it is. Because I know all that I need to know about what's going on with this tawdry love affair. His wife is probably getting fired because of her personality issues. Larry is a piece of shit.
Oh, big time. It's also really funny how Angie is basically the 20-something living the life of all of Cal's cuties 35 years later.
It's true.
In SVU, journos are murder victims just waiting to happen. Mm-hmm. I do really want to see the After Hours S&M Club undercover journalist episode. I feel like we were deprived of that.
Yeah, Whips and Chains, Inc. was the title of the story, which is a pretty good one.
I love that picture of her like shooting up from the magazine spread.
But
that was also great.
I mean, I just feel like they need to do more research on this, because S&M clubs are typically involving willing participants. You know, like the human urinal did not have to be like cajoled into doing that. No, right. He wasn't forced to do that.
That's a thing.
That was really into
so,
that.
So sure, it's on the fringe, but are you really going to, kink shame?
No, exactly. And heroin smuggler trying to target children. I don't know. But like, for one thing, it seems like a dangerous game to play. Like, a heroin smuggler probably has some heavies, right?
Yeah.
And they don't care if you're a journalist or not. Why would that be the person targeting the children? I don't know. It's just a little thin. Are we skipping over the really salacious, non-consensual nudity? And because she is, her ass is barely covered.
That's true.
And that's about it. Everything else is bare skin tied up with what they say is telephone cables, but it like looks to me, after having watched 8 seasons of Alone, like snare wire. We're treated to multiple angles of her naked corpse.
Okay, so they go to visit Ostabau.
Yep, Ostabau.
Mm-hmm. And Elliot just assumes that he's dumping the dead dogs in the Hudson.
I know. I totally forgot about this Ostabell character.
The haloed animal artwork on the walls in Eternal Peace Mortuary are inspired. This is peak insanity, like the wildest art department stuff you could hope for.
Dogs with wings and shit, right?
There are so many pets with halos and wings made to be angels. It is positively insane and entirely delightful.
Is that what you look for in a mortuary? Do you like walk into like a regular ass funeral home and expect to see grandma with wings on her back? You know,
that would be awesome. I want, if I can't be shot out of a cannon, I want that to be.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to have a trebuchet launch you onto the tundra.
Well, I would settle for that too. Like in there's an episode of Northern Exposure.
I think it's
that
the pilot,
happens.
Isn't it the first episode?
Yeah, I think so. There's also an episode where they fucking fling a piano, so I can't remember right, which is which. And they also fling a cow.
Yeah.
Or no, they fling the piano instead of the cow, I think is what it is. Anyway, so Ostabau turned his life around in prison through pet therapy, apparently. and then he calls Jane Whitmore a bitch, I believe, and says that she only boned him until she could tell he wasn't a story anymore.
He actually might have said bitch the most hatefully, because he said that bitch. Yeah.
I would posit that maybe Atherton did, because he actually killed.
He killed a lot. Yeah. But Ostabell had a fair amount of invective in his voice when he said that. It's just insane. The fact that even these people are able to do any acting with the amount of exposition that has to take place in this episode. Yeah.
No, everyone's an exposition dump for really like the whole thing.
Because all of a sudden you're like, okay, now Jacqueline Smith is going to get to do some weepy acting or something. And you look and there's 5 minutes left. There's no time.
Nope.
There's no time.
Nope. Just exposition. We need more. We need more. We need more. There's so much plot here. There's 5 episodes of plot and you need to tell us all about what happened 35 years ago because we cannot show it. We do not do flashbacks. Mm-mm. Okay, so Francine, the tweaker in rehab, she's actually made up convincingly.
She is. She looks like so we get to the halfway house, and I gotta say,
we do.
The halfway house to me, it looked kind of perfectly decent. I honestly don't know what it didn't look like a.
There is a big problem
with the guy with the face tats.
Or no,
you're talking about Atherton. Okay, but Atherton is working for the welfare administration, right? So, but the house itself, like. That is, you know, claimed to be a den of you know, drugs and prostitution. It was clean. It had a sizable library. The only thing that looked off was that there was
But do we know what the books in the library were?
It's true, but there was like a menacing dude with face tats, like who was in the background of every shot, and it's like, okay, that's how we know that it's bad.
This is sketch city.
Yeah. It's like an enigma from the Jim Rose Circus is just hanging out.
Not Enigma, the recording artist.
No.
Michael Cretu.
No, the guy who was in that classic X-Files episode. I can't remember what it's called, but yeah.
So then we get to
Francine. She is convincing as a tweaker with her makeup.
Yep. And I looked at a picture of her normally. She looks great.
Yeah, she doesn't have that.
Does not look like a tweaker.
Shit on her face.
It doesn't have her hair is like Brandon Crawford level wet.
Yeah.
Like really greased.
They didn't
hair.
Really do a job of greasing her up for that role. Didn't do the same to
not
Benson.
So much with Liv. Her hair still looks way too good to have spent the last 3 days on the street. Yeah. 6-time employee of the year, Dickless, gets too close to Liv. I don't like this.
He grabs.
I hope they didn't. I hope they used an intimacy coordinator, but I'm sure they didn't because, you know, this is fucking, 2010. So
this is what, like, didn't. Atherton's entire role, I really wonder how much was in the script and how much was Atherton. Because there's a few things that he does where it's just like, was that just him? Was that just
him? I've heard that he's a really nice guy.
I'm not saying that he grabbed Liv's breast without having like
without blocking the scene.
Yeah,
but
But but that's what happened. It's something. There. Yeah.
It is something. So I guess we're to learn from this that employees of the year are all serial rapists and murderers, right?
Well, he's also a you know, he's a welfare administration worker. He's a social worker.
He's a bureaucrat.
He's a bureaucrat who works on behalf of poor people. Now, whenever we've seen people like this in the past, they're rapists.
Like in the Chicago PD crossover?
Yeah, there was the Chicago PD crossover. Yeah, that's where there was a whole like bunch of pedo rapists.
Yeah, the pedo rapist ring that was all social
run
workers.
Out of the social administration. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So Cragen doesn't pick up on the bedtime butcher until way like they already the calling card was established. Cragen remembers this eventually. It seems really bizarre for him not to remember it until they have him in questioning.
Yeah.
They've already they even establish who they think it is. They think it's Bogdan. So why wouldn't he at least remember it when he sees a guy old enough to have been the bedtime butcher, you know?
Josh, there were so many like entire plot arcs in this episode. You can't exactly expect them
to think logically about how this should have unfurled. But I don't know. That's just a weird sticking point for me that I
agree. It takes him a little while before Cragen goes like,
It's like the anti-Deus Ex Rollinsa, you know?
It's like this very specific calling card that came from a time when I was new on the job. And so probably was a little more, you know, like everything stuck in my mind a little bit better. Huh. That was never fully solved. Maybe I'd remember that.
But nope.
Or maybe, you know, you put that into they have a system. They put in MOs from time to time. I guess it's not, that only happens when they need it to happen. It's not standard operating procedure to like search prior MOs. Anyways.
But he remembered it.
I know.
He remembered it unprompted, like off the top of his head. So like it seems bizarre to have not connected the dots before this. Anyway, whatever. How dumb is this fucker that he let his trail go cold while still setting himself up to be able to leverage his power for sex? Only to return to his old signature, allowing them to tie him to 5 ice cold rape murders from 35 years before that had like, it's not like they were lucky that he left dandruff on the evidence. That is literally the only thing that they were able to like concretely connect him with.
At first, Warner's like, there's no hair or semen. So there's no hair or fluids, but wouldn't they find the dandruff right away and be like, there was dandruff?
Also, is dandruff DNA really going to keep for 30 plus years?
I it's a good question. I didn't look into that. But
I mean, I don't know how one would look into that, but it seems like a large leap.
it also seems like the sort of thing they were like, how are we going to connect this? Dandruff.
Also, what fresh hell would that men's retreat in Cheyenne have been like in 1976? Like, do you think that's sort of the, like, origins of the men's rights movement happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not like a gay cowboy orgy, probably.
Although given Atherton's backstory, maybe.
Yeah, but given his character, though, probably unlikely.
No, probably not.
It's just astounding the velocity with which we pound through this
hurdle from
storyline.
Yeah. That is over now.
Because we're like
at like minute 16 maybe.
But he gives,
then it's like
one of the most inspired little flourishes, because they're already like, this guy's cooked, and they come outside of the interview room, and while they're talking, he just like kind of sidles up to the mirror and starts like fixing his hair in the mirror in a just delicious way. You know, he's like
this. Okay, so it goes from journalist murdered, raped and killed, to bedtime butcher cold case, and to copycat female staging the killing of the mattress maestro's wife to fit that MO by minute like 20. You know, like two full plot twists that are pretty insane. I really love how inspired this is. Now the mattress maestro adds,
this is my favorite part of the episode.
This is also one of the laziest errors possible.
What's that?
The commercials are shot in 16 by 9. No goddamn way they're shooting those commercials in 16 by 9. Those are 4 by 3.
That's hysterical. They obviously were not shooting television in 16 by 9 back then.
But how did no one fucking, it's not like they were, it's not like these were ads that were running at movie theaters. These were TV ads. Like, this is batshit.
People did not have flat screen TVs with wide aspect ratios back then.
Nope. Even fucking big screen TVs were 4x3. Like the big screen projection TVs back in the day, those were all 4x3. All
of them. And, yeah. God, this brings up a whole nother can of words, because like back in the day, you used to get pan and scan where they'd cut off the edges of films so they'd fit in your classic TV. And that was annoying. Because like, why not just put in letterbox? The boxes at the top and the bottom don't bother me. What they do now is a fucking abomination, where they cut off like half of the screen to make an old show look like it's actually designed for your modern 16:9 screen. It's just like, what the hell?
Basically what they do with the first season of SVU.
Do they do that in for
I
SVU?
Believe so, yeah.
Man,
I'm pretty sure that was brutal. Not shot in 16:9.
Absolutely brutal. Sorry.
The ads are super fun.
Tons of fun.
That aside, you know, the aspect ratio, it's a huge gaffe.
Yeah.
Now, I almost wish they hadn't cast two like such prominent women in these roles for the sake of the story.
Yeah.
Because like, obviously Jacqueline Smith isn't just going to be some random uni.
Wait, what are Charlie's Angels?
Yeah. Also, she would never, ever, never remember the name of Maud Monaghan 34 years later.
Without like, her that memos. Is yeah.
insane. You would not remember such a sort of one time at the office, like his agent or manager or whatever. Yeah. Like, that's insane.
Granular detail that you wrote down in a notebook and handed to a detective, because she wasn't the investigating officer. She was just the first person on the scene.
She was just a uni.
Yeah.
So Anne Margaret is going boozy for this one.
Rita.
Detective. Well, I'm not surprised you came back. Mm-hmm. I saw the way you looked at me. Threesome. And here I thought you were a missionary position kind of guy. Mm. Want a drink, huh?
No, and I think you've had enough, too.
What are you, the sobriety police?
She's
wonderful.
She's sauced. She's pickled.
Stabler has that woman's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs line, which is... I swear I've heard him. I think that's been memeified.
Yeah.
Like, I swear I've heard that like on just a clip by itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that would make sense. I mean, that's a very memeable,
like
gif-able moment when he says that.
Now, but she's, when
they bring her in for questioning and she has a flask.
Well, you mean when, but you've skipped.
I mean, I've skipped
the most important scene of hers, where they go back to her place and
she
opens the door the second time and it's just Elliot who she can see. And she's like, oh, you're back. Yeah. And
then Benson pops up.
And she says, ooh, threesome or whatever. Like, holy shit. I mean, obviously you're just going to cut in that whole scene.
Of course.
But
yeah.
Holy shit, that's the Emmy moment.
That's the Emmy moment. And then when she wields her martini glass at Stabler.
After shattering it on her door. Yeah.
Just fantastic shit. Really over the top. And then they bring her in. And what I find so funny is because they've just arrested her for, you know, I don't know. They could charge her with like assaulting a police officer.
Well, they just
officer.
Brought her in for questioning, I think.
But they could charge her with assault.
Yeah, they could charge
at this
her
point.
With that.
Like,
yeah.
like if they True. Thought that she was a real suspect, they could hold her. Mm-hmm. So they brought her in for this. They didn't let her, like, go get her shit together. They just brought her in. And she has a goddamn flask with her.
She has a flask, yeah. Fantastic. So we find a lot out about Cal here, and he is a real piece of shit.
Oh, my God.
But she loves him, and oh, my God.
She loves him so much, man.
She loves him so much that she saved the menstrual sheets from his bed.
As one does.
That he wanted her to throw out
as
for 34 years. And not only did she save them, but they're wrapped in a fucking bow.
You know, I just envy the amount of storage she has in her apartment that she has a spot for her bloody menstrual sheets after all this time.
And her apartment is a shrine.
It sure is.
To the mattress maestro.
It's the creepiest shit since since that Alan Partridge episode.
I love that so much.
She can barely move in her apartment for all of the mattress maestro paraphernalia she has.
Art department really got to knock it out of the park on this episode. They got to do the cal sets,
the dog art,
uh-huh. And this entire apartment.
And in Mon Monahan's office too. I don't know if you noticed how she had a glorious wall of celebs that have worked for her. Like, there was a lot. They had a lot of fun.
It's funny because she's basically super drunk Miss Havisham with a healthy dose of begrudging abortion mixed in.
When I saw that she was, you know, Blanche Devereaux from Streetcar, I was like, I can see that.
Yeah, it's that
a very
tracks.
Blanche-y role.
And then, as if this wasn't insane enough, they decide that they have to mix in a homeless man's body used to fake your own death into the mix.
Well,
and it leaves Cal burned to unrecognizable proportions. And this is five different crazy soap opera storylines fit into one episode of SVU.
It sure is. And I mean, it's like appropriate casting, right? Because they had the right actors to pull off this level of over the top, right? It kind of honestly reminds me of that X-Files with the freak show X-Files, right? That has Enigma in it. Because it's like an episode of the show that kind of feels going in like it's an X-Files episode. But then it just goes like so over the top, ridiculous with the premise, which in this case is like, you know, sideshow acts. Or in that case, it's sideshow acts. In this case, it's like ridiculous early 80s soap opera. Oh, yeah. And it has ridiculous early 80s soap opera stars in it. It's
this
perfect.
This is like someone sat around watching all of like As the World Turns, Guiding Light, GH.
The guy who played Cal was
all of them.
800 episodes of Guiding Light. And we didn't even talk about him.
We couldn't.
He was on it for like 40 years.
Yeah. But it's like, what's the point? Yeah. I don't have the time.
Now, I would say this is one part where they went too far because the makeup is distracting.
Nope. Disagree.
I really thought it was like, is that Dan Aykroyd from Nothing But Trouble? What the fuck?
And we've got a woman doing the gaslighting here. This is just late barriers are just like, wow.
You can roll the dice and he's just like, this week, we're doing it all.
Yeah. I've been doing this shit for 10 years. I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want now.
Do you know how many actors we have signed on to this one? Yeah. Give me more plot.
Oh, God. It's insane. Like, basically, this is just like a treasure trove of people that Gen X boys masturbated to in this episode.
Yes.
And boys older than us. We're still like outside of that target demographic.
Yeah. This was definitely the... Like the notch below the Farrah Fawcett poster, right? So you got the Farrah Fawcett poster, and then you've got like they're not. It's not that they're like any less, but just slightly less famous than that.
Yeah,
and,
but like there was a Morgan Fairchild poster too.
Oh yeah, and I mean,
and Jacqueline Smith was Charlie's Angel.
Yeah, and Susan Anton in Cannonball Run 2 is.
She's Lamborghini girl. Goddamn.
She's
name.
Lamborghini
That's
girl.
That's her character's name.
She's wearing a vinyl bodysuit the entire film.
She was second runner up in Miss America in 1969. Like,
yeah. I mean, these
to make no mention of Anne Margaret, who is a sex pot.
Yes. The amount of money invested in blowouts and hair drying in general for these women throughout their careers is astronomical.
Yeah.
And
yeah, their HMU budget, their combined like four people HMU budget adjusted for inflation is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million. Yeah. And I'm not exaggerating.
And as my wife pointed out as we were watching this last night, you could teach a semester's class on plastic surgery based on
yeah.
on their lives. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Anybody could do what they want, but
oh man, such a fucking wild episode.
I fucking love it. And you have Atherton in it, who's like doesn't even act against these people, and he's
and of course they got to bring in Helen Shaver to direct.
Helen Shaver directed this one.
Yes, and that's why we're doing
fantastic.
Desert Hearts, which you will have just been able to listen to if you're a patron.
Exactly. Yep. So this is one that Josh has been itching to drop for a long time. We're unlikely to get any future Patricia Charbonneau episodes.
Yeah, we've already seen her episodes.
Yeah, we're waiting for another Shaver directed bomb to drop. Speaking of bombs that dropped, there's going to be a new showrunner next season in season 24.
Yeah. So if you're listening, new showrunner, Adam and I are more than welcome to come aboard, join the writing staff. We'll bring it back to these crazy barriers if you want. We can write the Armie Hammer cannibal episode.
We can.
Right now. And we know who should play Armie Hammer. And so.
We understand the characters. We appreciate the kind of modern take of the show, which is that they're not doing... Yep. They're not doing just straight up homicide investigations like they did in this episode, where they're actually doing something that Special Victims Unit might do. We appreciate that. But we can make it nuts if you'd like us to.
Yeah, we can make it nuts. Yeah. There can be nuts episodes still, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the Armie Hammer one would be nuts.
It would be delightful. Delicious. Let's see.
Scrumptious.
I mean, there's so many fun lines. I mean, just like so many. Like one of my favorites, going back a little bit, was Benson tells Atherton,
"You know, well, in my experience, it's guys who brag about their conquests that usually fall a little short below the belt."
"You don't know what you're talking about.
The truth hurts. And Jane was going to splash it all over the front page. Of course, you'd have to use small print."
So we've got a guess William Atherton's dong size challenge that Liv has thrown out.
And I think she's assuming maybe she could feel it in her back. Yeah. And she wasn't impressed, that's for sure.
No. But then later we've got a... the maestro couldn't keep his baton in his pants line. Like a lot of delightful dick jokes. And I mentioned that Susan, Jacqueline Smith lives in my neighborhood. In fact, Bandit and I were walking just the other day and almost got hit by a driver who was pulling out of, there's like a driveway at that address. And we almost got run over because that person was looking at their phone.
You mean Susan Delzio?
It was, well, I mean this.
Not actual real life Jacqueline Smith.
Yeah, Susan Delzio, exactly. Yeah, I don't know where Jacqueline Smith lives. She might live in that building.
I think she lives in Chicago, it's a nice actually. Building,
but yeah.
I think her husband is a surgeon in Chicago. Yeah. I could be wrong on that though.
Nice. I think we're ready to rank this thing, Josh. You know, because this is one I really recommend watching. It's so much fun. It's kind of a mess, but it's a kind of delightful mess that I think Josh and I are really here for.
I don't mind an episode being a mess if it's like this.
Exactly, and I'm kind of exactly the same way. So. Obviously, as Josh alluded to, we rank these episodes. We are trying to build a composite score so that we can line all of them up against each other eventually and see where they all lie. There'll be well over 500 episodes of this show by the time we're done watching them all. But the way we do that is a four-part scale. We rank on quality. That's the overall quality of the episode. The quality of the guests. How problematic the episode was, and the depth and breadth of lives ruined. Now, I have a feeling this one's going to tick a couple boxes.
Yeah.
I guess let's start with, let's go back to front. Let's start with depth and breadth of lives ruined. Because there's kind of a lot of bodies in this one, right?
Yeah.
Just.
Yep. There are
seven dead bodies by my count. So you have the six.
The homeless guy?
The homeless guy, the five victims of the bedtime butcher, and the. And
the wife.
And the wife, exactly.
So that's.
That's
yeah, seven.
Seven bodies. Plus, you have the wreck.
Generations of welfare needing women and women needing food stamps who are having to see Ned Bogdan, six-time employee of the year,
yeah.
And
just
have to put out for him.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like it's just like a part of the job. Like it's only Jane would think that was something worth writing a story for if you were used to doing that. So that's pretty fucked up. You have Susan, what's her name? Wills, Lisa Wills? Was that
Rita Wills?
Rita Wills, sorry. You have Rita Wills, who has been so broken by her experience with Cal Cutler that she's completely lost her mind and devolved into drunkenness and
She's crawled into a bottle.
Yeah, and this weird, you know, like deification of her ex-boyfriend. So that's pretty fucked up.
The one who made her get the abortion.
Yeah, that she did not want. It's pretty. And then you've got even to Angie, who's being forced to climb down a fire escape in not really like dressed for the weather. I mean, it's a nice house sweater, but not what you go outside to trudge through the snowdrifts.
Nothing underneath it.
Yeah, exactly.
She is tits out in the bra on the fire escape when she sees the dead body.
And that's a great line.
Safe to say that's the last time she goes to visit that guy.
One would think. I feel like Larry's spot got blown up that night.
I don't think her leaving via the fire escape is going to escape the notice of his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know. What are we talking here? This is pretty fucking high.
I mean, it's not a 10, but it's an 8 or a 9 for sure.
There's a lot of death. There's only one that I think is really has that kind of like depth of feeling, and that's the Anne Margaret character, where we really go like, man, this lady.
Yeah, a lot of it's off screen, and 35 years earlier.
Yeah, but Anne Margaret's character is like, man, this lady is fucked.
Yeah,
and it's rare to kind of see that, like the person who's
right. Oh, we also have Liv getting her tit grabbed.
Yeah, Liv got felt out. Mm-hmm.
By murderer and rapist,
a serial killer. Let's be honest. A serial killer who decided to stop killing
and just rape
because it was so fun raping welfare recipients. I think it's a 9 personally.
It's really his like 30 years of fucking raping women.
Well, but also 35 years. I mean, there's a lot of bodies. It's the 35 years of raping women, and it's Anne Margaret's just like shell of a person, right? So it's
the crazy thing is so much of the damage happens in ways that don't really affect the tone of this episode at all.
Yeah, true, absolutely. It's bizarre because
it's still a rollicking good time despite seven bodies dropping that are like investigated kind of through the course of this episode.
I'm saying 9 if you're okay with that.
That's fine. I'm fine with
so
that.
Problematic. Now again, this is crazy problematic, right? It's got
menstrual sheets for 34 years.
Menstrual sheets for 30. Everything about Anne Margaret is problematic. The menstrual sheets, the cardboard cutouts, just her entire apartment. The drunken meandering, the fact that she just has a flask on her person at all times.
The threesome proposition.
The threesome proposition.
To live in Elliot.
But then everything about Atherton is problematic too. I mean, like, he turns the dial up from every second he's on screen. He is full blown.
Our cold open.
The cold open is fantastic.
and problematic.
Yes, Cal's melted face at the end.
Fantastic. Love that.
What I don't quite understand is why he wasn't being cuffed.
Burning up a homeless man?
Yeah.
Just
why he wasn't being let off in cuffs at the end, or were they just waiting before to lock him up? Because he killed the homeless man.
He killed the homeless man.
Yeah.
Or he at least burned up the body.
Yeah.
They probably killed him together. But
yeah. Man. Yeah. So much going on.
I don't think it's a 10, no, but I think it's probably a 9, right?
It's so much fun. It's so much fun, and it's so crazy that I can't see not giving it a 9. I mean, that cold open alone is just delicious. The Liv gets felt up.
Down the fire escape, like in a bra, like then seeing the bot, like it's.
I felt compelled to make a bitch count because they say bitch so often, and it was at least 6 times. I might have miscounted. Yeah. It might have been 7.
There's a lot of misogyny. In this episode.
Oh my god. So I want to skip. Nah.
Okay.
Oh, no, let's just do it. Guess. I mean, this is like having. Yeah. Recognizable stars populate the entire thing.
Yeah. It's a lot of recognizable stars. You've got Robert Newman doing great work in the Mattress Maestro ads.
I mean, honestly, he does great work.
And Anne Margaret are both doing a lot of work here too.
Uh-huh.
And Anne Margaret did get an Emmy she is really going big, but I don't see any way to read that on the page and not decide that you had to. I mean, the character on the page saves menstrual sheets for 34 years and propositions a threesome that, with Elliot and Liv.
Presumably, yeah, the threesome proposition was on the page. We don't 100% know, but presumably.
I hope she ad-libbed that.
But definitely the menstrual sheets was a major plot point, so that was definitely there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they had to have art department on board with that because they had to bloody the gift wrap sheet. Good job, props.
Yeah. I mean, so, but she's going extremely big, and it's fun. It's fun to see people go that big. Atherton is going. He's full Atherton. You know, he's doing the pedantic asshole bureaucrat thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which he kind of invented that role. I feel like.
Yeah.
Does anybody play that like he does?
No, that's why you get Atherton to do this.
Yeah.
Like you're like, hey, just Ghostbusters this shit up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's Dr. Jerry Hathaway to you, you know. Then you have,
is this a 10?
I don't see how it's not a 10, Josh. Because like,
she won an Emmy.
Because then you have like three.
She won an Emmy for this. Yeah. You've got utter insanity. You have Morgan Fairchild basically has 30 seconds of screen.
I know.
Time. That's how
I
nuts know. This episode is.
And you're like, oh shit, that's Morgan Fairchild. And then she's gone.
Yeah. You're like, wait, that was what Morgan Fairchild got to do?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Just fantastic shit. I mean, in Newman, Robert Newman, like, really gets to do a lot with the short amount of time he gets to act. His two commercials, we see two commercials and we see him like in burn suit.
He was in makeup for like probably 4 hours for that shot.
It's like a 12-hour day for him.
For 30 seconds of screen time.
I mean, I guess he didn't have to do that much because his face is in a like perpetual, like, you know, frown. But wow, a lot of fun. Yeah, I
think that's the 10 here.
It's got to be a 10. I mean, in this one, it's just like we're throwing it all at the wall and seeing if any of it sticks. And it's kind of more of it sticks than maybe it could have. I like,
or should have.
Like, I mean, I guess Jacqueline Smith is not. I don't know. You kind of like you know that it's her as soon as she shows up, and B,
yeah,
you she doesn't get to do
she,
very
she
much.
Doesn't have any juicy stuff because she's basically having to sit there playing it cool and trying to misdirect the investigation to.
Well, because she has to be like the straight one, right? We already have Anne Margaret as the over the top, you know, red herring.
I mean Morgan Fairchild gets to do her little bit and not that.
I mean, and Susan 45 Anton, seconds. Yeah, but, they both have 30 seconds to be like, remember me, this is who I was, and I'm believably this person now.
Yeah.
God damn it. I hate you so.
I think we can knock this out.
Yeah, we got to get this out in 10 minutes. We can do it, man. Yeah. So last category, that is quality overall. I feel like maybe it's too much of a mess to give it incredibly high marks.
Yeah, I'm thinking 6 or 7.
It's really fun.
Yeah, it's really fun, but I think
a lot
that's
of that is reflective
in the
problematic and in the guests, because it's like it's yeah. Anne Margaret mm-hmm. and yeah. and Atherton that are really fun. I don't know. Benson and Stabler have some really fun shit to do.
Yeah.
It's weird that Wong and Kragen are even in it, because so much happens, and I guess yeah. Kragen kind of moves the plot around, but Wong's just like, no, I think that Morgan Fairchild did it. I think it's like his sole contribution.
Like, it's not like it's not fun, but I think we've accounted for all of the fun, and I think we need to sort of focus on the fact that, again, this is
at least 4 or 5 episodes. Conservatively, yeah, 5 episodes could yeah. be made from this. Uh-huh. You could yes. even do more.
And instead, it's one.
You could do an entire episode out of the cold open.
You could do an entire episode in the rehab center.
Oh, yeah, the rehab
without center. Without the cold case serial rape.
The rehab center, the pet.
Cold case being used for the cover up of the, or the homeless man being used to
the homeless man, the pet mortuary. I mean, you have just like, yeah. just like ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
You could have had, I mean,
you've also got a lot of people doing a lot of exposition.
Yes.
Which they find a way to make fun, but you're not really seeing much happen that isn't something that happened 35 years before this episode of television.
That's entirely true. That is entirely true. Realize it.
So they're right. relatively low stakes once Ned Bogdan is put down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think because it's still so fun.
You want to say 7? Because I think it's getting a very high score. Even if we give it a 6, it's getting.
Let's
a high
take
score.
It to 6, just because I don't think it's.
It's not a perfect episode of the show, right? No, by any means. Like, it is a lot of fun, and I would highly recommend watching mm-hmm. it, but it's not perfect. And, you know, we've gotten to those rarefied heights where we've seen a perfect episode. We know what that is. So that gives us an 8.5, which ties it with some pretty fun episodes, Josh. The other 8.5s that we've seen were Wet. That was, they dropped it like Lindsay dropped her tampon to be eaten by Killer. That was Munch My Benson, episode 95. SVU, season 12, episode 5. And also, Slaves got an 8.5. That was season 1, episode 22. We covered it in episode 54. I really got to do a rectal so, ... Let me see how many season 11 episodes we've watched really quick before we roll the next one. Because I feel like...
Not many.
Not that many. Yeah, it's one of the...
I think we've only watched like 2, right?
No, more than you think. We've watched... So in addition to Bedtime, we watched Solitary. He got down with an arthropod, where we also saw a fantastic... Did he not get an Emmy nomination for that performance? Stephen Ray?
I don't think so.
Which, that was a really good performance. I think I'd safely say it was, I'd vote for that above Anne Margaret, even though I thought Anne Margaret was delicious and delightful.
Thankfully, they were not competing against one another.
This is true. So we also seen Unstable. That was We Don't Even Care About the Teenage Orgy. Witness, It Sucked That D-Bag Rape Boy was going to be the last guy to lay pipe in McCallum County. And Turmoil, that is another second unit photo shoot gone wild. So theme of season 11, all of those episodes were pretty kind of bonkers.
Yeah, Turmoil was not good.
Yes.
But it was definitely insane.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I guess actually I take that back, because the Stephen Ray episode was not bonkers, but it was very good. So,
well, I mean, Elliot did engage in a relationship with a cockroach. So.
As one does. That's what solitary confinement does to a man, Josh. Yeah.
True.
All right. So I think on that note, it is time to roll the next one.
So heading over to episode.lol, which was built for this podcast by friend of the pod, Flat. Tape is spinning. Bill and Ted are hurtling through the tubes of space-time.
Oh, I hate that part.
And we have landed in episode 1 of season 10. Trials.
Interesting.
Olivia discovers that a case involving a troubled foster child is tied to a cold rape case from her past. Ooh. And it could be the missing link that could help catch a serial rapist. Meanwhile, Olivia is haunted by her sexual assault in prison. This one features Julie Bowen, Sarah Gilbert,
okay,
and Luke Perry.
Ooh.
That's why I wouldn't tell you when I drew it off air.
Thank God. Finally. So, I was worried we were going to wait till episode 500 to watch this episode.
Nope.
This is an all-timer, guys.
All-timer.
Really, really wild.
You definitely, definitely want to watch this one. Mm-hmm.
Clear your schedule, right? Like, get the popcorn done beforehand. Yep. Get your beers prepped. Be ready to watch this one, guys.
Yeah. You are in for a treat.
But Josh, I only have 3 minutes and 35 mm-hmm. seconds left on this recording, so let's thank some folks and tell them where they can find us.
So we are on the socials at Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as Munch My Benson. Mm-hmm. We have an email address, munchmybenson@gmail.com. You can find us on Patreon, where you get access to unedited versions of these episodes. That is patreon.com/munchmybenson. We have a website, munchmybenson.com, where you can link to all that stuff as well. We just appeared on Fuck My Work Life. Yeah. So F**k My Work Life. If you're having to search on Apple Podcasts, rate and review the podcast wherever you listen. Am I forgetting anything?
I don't think so. We do have merch available now. We will have more as it comes. The link to it is in the show notes or from the website or from our Twitter. So look on those. It's on Zazzle, but we have a couple things available. Again, I should have just done the low-hanging fruit first, but I didn't. Yeah. I tried to do the big job first, and the big job was hard, and the low-hanging fruit was easy. So Josh convinced me to get my head out of my ass and just get the easy stuff up. So I got easy stuff there, and I'll keep adding to it as we go. So it's not done. Definitely consider checking back in. I've tried to keep the prices kind of somewhat reasonable, but...
And by the time this drops, maybe
there'll be more stuff.
Who's going to change my bag will be up.
Yeah, that's going to require a little bit of work. That's the big one. That's the fun one. Yeah. But you can get a Munch My Benson t-shirt in any color you like. And we do also have koozies available. So still some fun stuff there. But yeah, guys, I think that's it, man. I think it's time to get out there and start munching.
Of a lifetime. I don't know if you remember, but Cal Cutler was a bit of a local celebrity back in the mid-70s.
His ads were on every 5 minutes on Channel 11.
I want to lay you. Once you get that ocean in motion on one of my waterbeds, well, in 9 months, you're going to need a baby bed, and guess what? I got those, too.
I bet he was still bouncing with those blondes long after the camera stopped.